Hello, and welcome back to the fourth night of Millennial 2020. This is the third of four streams tonight. And this is with the inimitable Semiogog. So welcome, Semiogog, to Millennial 2020.
Good to be here. It's the third year in a row. We're getting old, but never fear, I'm much older than you are.
Well, it's been a pleasure each year, so I'm very happy to have you back. Before we get into the topic at hand, which is a specific topic, which I think will be interesting to quite a few people, do you want to give general impressions about 2020? I know it's a dreadful topic, a dreadful question, but you know, what do you think? I mean, this has been, yeah, because the last time we spoke, well, it's obviously 12 months ago, and everyone was thinking, it's a new decade, the 2020s, you know, exciting possibility and so on. And would you agree that, you know, the events of this year have somewhat dimmed that enthusiasm?
Yes, quite. But my view, which is, I don't know if it's entirely popular at the moment, and it's certainly dismissed out of hand by quite a few people, is that what we have here is an apparent cascading series of fuck-ups that will shortly be pulled up out of the nosedive and revealed as triumph. So, yeah, I tend to think that we are on the threshold of a great turning, and that will happen in weeks, not months, and things will turn out rather nicely. But I mean, beyond that, there's, of course, all sorts of any number of horrific things that have been going on. You know, the Great Reset, Klaus Schwab wearing some weird Lithuanian or Latvian, some Baltic graduation attire that looks like a Klingon uniform.
It's like Emperor Ming.
Yeah, it's some sort of strangeness. Yeah. And we have no Flash Gordon at the moment. Yeah, it's just lockdown and imposition and oppression of the variety we've all become so accustomed to. It's just, you know, it's just like the usual, except more.
Yeah, suddenly it's interesting because for a long time people talked about an encroaching, you know, police state, 1984, all that surveillance, that kind of thing. And I always thought, no, that's not how it's going to be because the governments just aren't competent enough to do that. But, well, I guess they've found a way to, which is to offload it onto the private corporations to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, even incompetence can be oppressive scum. So, yeah, they'll find a way.
So what you just said earlier is it makes it sound like you think that, I mean, I'm guessing that you were referring to Trump winning the election in a few weeks.
Yes, and quite a bit more that will come with that, because in order for him to do so, it's my belief at any rate that he will have to act on any number of things that have caused everyone a great deal of frustration for quite some time because he hasn't done so. And it's my belief that it's a wait to see the whites of their eyes strategy. The other thing is that once you've used a weapon in a situation where you're up a weapon, so to speak, when you're up against groups, forces, peoples, entities, organizations, any and all of these things that are as powerful as these are, you've revealed it. And you've lost surprise and initiative. And so what's happened is he has behaved, I believe, as a, on the surface, people will read him as a bumbling fool for not having acted all this time. And then when he does, many of these things will come down. We have shoes waiting to drop, so to speak, for Edward Snowden. We have shoes waiting to drop for Assange. We have shoes waiting to drop on Clinton. We have this figure of Flynn, who seems to me to be a kind of heat-seeking missile with Obama's name on it, you know, so to speak. There's the business of Russiagate. There are any number of things that are waiting in the wings. And if they all are true. I mean, there's Epstein still waiting, for crying out loud. And there are all sorts of, you know, stories about digital information and photographs and probably video clips and logs of guests and visitors that were all reportedly seized when his apartment was taken. And that sort of leverage didn't just go away. Whose hands did it fall into? So there are any number of these things. We'll see. If I have to eat crow in 2 weeks, I will publicly and happily do so, but I expect it will be the other way around.
All right. Well, that's a nice, it's nice to hear someone say that, because it's refreshing, because so many people that I know have just given up over the last few weeks. I have to say, including myself, you know, I it seems like up until about a week, 10 days ago, I was thinking he's going to pull this off, but something happened. I can't even remember what it was now, but I thought, it's just looking increasingly distant and desperate at this point. But I'd love it if he did win because of the massive repercussions that it would have. As you say, it's not just that I desperately want another 4 years of Donald Trump in the White House, like the last 4 years we've had. I don't. But I do want the shockwaves that it would have in the world at large.
And there's also the small matter of Biden being who and what he is. And the next little horrific bitter pill in the Pez dispenser, which is what's her name? You know, the one who looks like the dude from No Country for Old Men. You know, the ethnically indistinct creature. So, you know, in addition to Trump being the better of the two alternatives, you know, there's sort of a long, nasty black chute down into the nether regions that it looks like we'll all be sliding down if something isn't done here.
Right. Yes. Okay. So, well, it is, as you say, it feels like a decisive moment. And this is what I was thinking like a month ago when the election happened. I could see, oh God, there's going to be, we're in for about 2 months of like a roller coaster during which there are going to be many ups and downs and twists and turns. And that's what's happened not quite as exciting as I'd hoped it was going to be, but there have been all these revelations along the way. And, well, it's not quite over yet. We've got another, as you say, 2 or 3 weeks left. So it's interesting. And I do hope that we're, I hope that you're right.
Yeah, so do I.
All right. So let's get into the topic then. You want to talk about the semiotics of nationalism. Now, before we get into that, we should first define what, because a lot of people don't know what semiotics means. So do you want to describe that?
Yeah, and just a very, very quick introduction. I believe it was your first interview. It was with On the Offensive, and you guys briefly talked about POMO stuff and Derrida and how meaning is manipulated in this sort of thing. And that's something I've been working on for quite some time from a different perspective, and that's what sort of kicked this off in my mind, the idea to talk about this a little. But semiotics, there are any number of ways that you can explain it, and many are too esoteric for an audience that's not aware of it from the outset. So the quickest way to describe it, rather than getting into continental semiology and Saussure versus semiotic and Peirce and formal logic, the semiotics is best understood as the study of meaning. People tend to focus on things like communication, but it really comes down to meaning. How meaning is conveyed, how it's understood, whether that's within an individual person or between persons in a community. And I guess the best way to look at it is, in fact, a way that this famous linguist Saussure discussed it. He talked about language. And in his day, they were beginning to really understand different linguistic groups like Indo-European. That guy had come back from India and said, wow, there's a lot in Sanskrit that's a lot like Latin and a lot like Greek. Maybe these families are united. And so Saussure, a Swiss dude, was at the forefront of sort of developing historical and comparative linguistics. And because he was comparing many languages, he realized that there might be themes that underpinned all of this, and indeed themes that extended beyond language itself. So you could look at how meaning is communicated with gesture, how meaning is communicated with songs that might have melodies but no words, how meaning can be communicated with rhythm, how it can be communicated with posture. For example, if I go like this, it sort of basically says stay back, sort of thrusting away motion, right? It doesn't require a dictionary. If I do this, you know, it's communicated more immediately without the need for social convention. Semiotics focuses on all of these things as the sort of field of meaning, and again, how it's understood, communicated, conveyed. And Saussure, at the time he was looking at this, said maybe we need something above linguistics, and that would be a field that doesn't exist yet, but he hypothesized that it would be called semiology. Now, sema just means sign from Latin, like semiotics, of course, but also semantics. So, you know, an old Greek word is sementor, which means someone who follows tracks or signs and therefore leads the community by looking at what those signs are and what they mean. Now, what has happened, and this is very much a part of what's going on with the left, and this is why I want to tackle this subject. What has happened is the left has focused heavily, heavily on language. And this has in large part come from linguisticians coming out of linguistics departments. And so the manipulation of meaning that we're all familiar with hinges heavily upon words and how words can be manipulated, how they can be changed. We're all familiar with the idea of political correctness, whereby once upon a time, there's a word that starts with N that comes from Latin and it means black, and it gets used to describe black people. But now we're not allowed to say it anymore. What we must say instead is Negro, which also comes from Latin and also means black. And then after a time, this is decided, you know, it's a terrible thing. We have to change it yet again so that we create some new rules that everyone can be on pins and needles wondering whether or not they're allowed to say it. And so they replace it with colored people, right? And we still have the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So it's not, you know, but forbidden for me to say it. The NAACP still exists. But then we're told colored people doesn't work anymore. What we have to say is black. Now, of course, the first two words that we dispensed with, the N word, as they like to say, and Negro both mean black. Now they just say black. Then after a time, black isn't permissible. What we have to say is that they're people of color. And so we see this continuing manipulation of meaning. And it serves any number of things. They like to point at how it signifies a given thing, but what it really does is create a people, a category of people who are terribly worried that they're always going to say the wrong thing and offend, and who look to a higher authority to help them to grasp ever more complex rules about what they're allowed to say and what they're not allowed to say. And that approach, which clearly involves a close attention to linguistics and how to manipulate things, is the one that we have suffered the fruits of in its application to our societies. And the ivory towers of academia that have produced these people who are specialists in language, in shifting meaning, they are at the center of all the problems that we face, much like people like, you know, the Marcuse, or, you know, pull any card from the deck of Frankfurt School or those who came afterwards, or take a look, for example, at Derrida that you were discussing briefly with On the Offensive. That approach has caused us enormous damage, and everyone now is beginning to see it. I just watched a clip that came out with this guy, Phil Klein, who's an attorney working on Trump's behalf, dealing with some of the legal cases that pertain to the election. And it's interesting. There's a clip of his where he does this Amistad press conference. It's from the last week. I'm going to be pulling elements of it to use in a clip probably. But in it, he talks about how people are, during the election, when ballots are being counted and you know, reckoned and tabulated, there is a there's this requirement that there be Republicans as well as Democrats in the location watching this go on. And he openly and explicitly talks about the fact that we would have never had the trouble that we've had if our language hadn't been undermined so thoroughly that we begin to play games with the word place. Because in the law, we have specific terms, and these are, in many cases, terms of art. You know, if you say some certain or date certain, that's a specific legal term that has specific legal meaning, like shell. If a judge says shell, it has very specific meaning. And if you want to understand what these terms mean, you have to dig something up like Black's Law Dictionary. But what this guy Klein was talking about was that there are statutory requirements that there be people in the polling place and that they be able to review the ballots as they're being cast. But he pointed out that the only way that these people could get away with what they've done is if our language was so undermined that we imagined that someone being in the place as described pretty much comes down to planet Earth. You know, as long as there was a Republican somewhere nearby, then, you know, but yet we all know that it's important that they be close enough to the ballots that they can review and read them.
Yeah.
And it's the same sort of thing where we talk about how men aren't women and women aren't men. And, you know, we add all sorts of strange letters at the end of sequences for different gender or sexual preference or not preference, because now we're not allowed to say it's a preference, you know. An instinct, for example.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's like, And we're, you and I are feeling this in real time with YouTube, and anyone who uses the social media platforms is feeling this in real time, because you're constantly thinking, well, can I say that? And can I say that in that way with those words?
And
can I say that with those words with this implication? I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's starting, and I know it's a big cliche to say this, but it is starting to feel like we live in a, you know, communist police state at this point, where you're constantly second guessing or third guessing. Is this all right to say?
And when you say,
is this going to get the knock on my door in the middle of the night, and you know someone's there saying you're banned from YouTube, sucker?
Kind of. And we know how the speech norms, the conventions, the speech conventions, the expectations within a society about how you speak. And this is essentially what the forces of progress have been so focused upon, is their belief that if you control the language, you control the scaffolding for thought, and you determine how things can be thought about. And
do you think that's true? I know that Orwell has this assumption in 1984 that the words that people know, the extent of someone's vocabulary governs the range of their thought. It governs the range of possible thought. Do you agree with that?
To an extent, but that's based on the Scrabble Babble Looney Tunes side of things, where everything is text, everything is word-based reasoning. There's a certain amount of truth to it. So one of the examples I like to use is you can talk about eros, and you can talk about philia, and you can talk about agape. Now, these are three Greek words that all get glossed as love in English. But is eros, which was sexual desire, or philia, which is brotherly love, or agape, which is non-judgmental love for all things that is complete and total, or at least of a particular thing, are these the same thing? And yet we say love. Like I joke about it, you could say, I love Brad Pitt. And someone else can say, I love moon pies. Well, is it really the same love? So there's a certain amount of truth to it, and that really brings us over into the realm of technical terminology, right? There's an entirely different world that a mechanic knows, or a bookbinder, or a physician. And indeed, you see with the so-called white-collar classes, with the, you know, cleric to clerk, you know, canon law, Latin, knowledge of the sacred scriptures before they got translated into the vulgar tongue. You know, those who are professionals, those who profess, they like to pick up very specific language and terminology that is exclusive to them, so that the groundlings don't understand it. So there are a couple things going on there. One is the way in which, if you don't have technical terms for a thing, you cannot get as specific. If you don't know what a foredge is on a book, the sewing band at the top, you know, there are specific things that you can't talk about precisely when you're dealing with repairing or binding anew a book. Likewise, if you don't know about the difference between the radius and the ulna, or the tibia and the fibula, or aerobic versus anaerobic infection, you know, there are certain things you can't do because you can't be precise. To that extent, I think that there is some truth to the idea that, you know, a word-shaped thought, but there's an entire domain of knowing, of meaning, that does not have that linguistic dimension. That's why, for example, when you see people perform on stage, you've got rhythm provided by the drummer, which is this whole semiotic current that you have to take into account. You've also got melody, right, and harmony, which, so to speak, gives color to the black and white sketch of the rhythm. But then you've also got someone who's singing, which means they're putting the melody into words that can be reflected upon. And when we have the proper full set, which has in large part been removed because of the old joke, you know, why don't Baptists fuck standing up, which is the punchline is because people will think they're dancing. You know, our culture has pushed dancing out of it. But if you have the rhythm, you have the melody, you have the harmony, you have the lyrics, and you have the movement and gesture embodied in the dance, then you have a complete package that can carry so much more semantic freight, so much more meaning than any of these things taken in isolation. Likewise, I already talked to you about gesture or movement or the growl of the dog. You know, you'd have to get into purse and semiotics and the ideas of firstness, secondness, and thirdness to really tackle that. I don't want to go deep into this area because it's it would use up all the time, and I'm not sure if the game would be worth the candle as a general introduction. What I want to come back to, if I may, is where you pointed out that you're constantly worried in what you say or by what you might say in terms of whether or not it's going to bring down the hammer of the law upon you, be cast out socially. You know, people throw rocks at you until you don't move anymore. You have to wear a scarlet letter or a dunce cap. You're going to be pushed out. So rather than thinking about the meaning of the words that they tell you that you have to worry about this week, look at what I laid out at the outset, which is that the rules about what you can say and how you can say it become so deeply ingrained in people's concerns that before they think, to say nothing of before they act, a pause has been foisted upon us between impression or experience and speech or action. So essentially, I look at this as a war upon instinct. If you're walking down the street and you see three persons of color and it's midnight, you're first going to think, you're not going to think. You're instinctively going to feel an impulse in many cases, certainly not all, you will feel an impulse to cross the damn street. But with that impulse comes that moment, that signal jamming that they so favor, which causes you to begin to stomp all over your dick and get tangled in your own underwear, trying to figure out whether or not it's a right thing or a wrong thing that you do. They've inserted the slow nature of the mental processes associated with word-based reasoning into what is otherwise an almost instantaneous and unconscious or subconscious, if not unconscious, drive, impulse, instinct to get
the hell out of the problem. See this. Yeah, and that same thing plays out all over the place, and you see it being encouraged. You see the leftists talking about removing unconscious bias and being aware of your privilege, the invisible knapsack, and all this stuff. They're teaching white people, basically, maybe middle class people, but it's really aimed at white people, I think. They're teaching white people to mistrust their instincts in every possible way, so that your life then becomes this constant process of examining yourself and chastising yourself for having instincts. In the meantime, everyone else is quite free, I think, still to just go by instinct. And not to say that that's all they do, but they are free to do that. Whereas I think white people are constantly being, there's this intense pressure to just not trust your instincts at all, really.
And who is it that is granted the authority to hand down the edicts from upon high regarding what you can and can't think and what you can and can't say? It's not simply that the gap has been created between the signifier and the signified. These are technical terms from linguistics. They come from Saussure. It's this basic idea that, you know, there is a thing that signifies, and there is that which it signifies. So you have the signifier and the signified. It was touched upon briefly in your discussion with on the offensive. And what's interesting to me is that that's not just a gap. It's a gap that is like the camel's nose in the tent. It's like the foot in the door. And it thrusts itself into that space between instinctive impulse and action. And there are so many dimensions of this that I'm really going to have to try to stay focused, because I can wind off everywhere with this in terms of showing you ways in which it applies. But I'd like to focus most on the idea of instinct and the natural world, because we have this idea, and that's my attack, which is forthcoming, which I've been working on now for more than a decade. A lot of people don't know I have an academic background as well. I dropped out of high school, but then I decided, fuck these people, I'm going to show them I can get in anyway. And so after that point, I was invited to participate in, you know, putting papers together for academic publications. I've been invited to conferences. I did a big one hosted inside the Swedish Parliament in 2010, where I presented some stuff. And big for me, it wasn't that large of an audience attending. but it was an achievement on my part. I've been invited to the University of Leiden to present on two occasions. I've done editing work for academic publications, and I've published some stuff of my own. And I've been for quite some time looking at this idea of how they attack us with linguistics and what the alternative is. Everyone knows they're doing it, but it's so damn effective, and they use it everywhere. So if the right is going to come up onto the stage and do something with this, well, the question is how. You have to identify what's being done to you, but you also have to identify what the alternative is. And I think what I have discovered, and to the best of my knowledge, I have uniquely discovered it. It is the idea that, I mean, others have talked about it, but no one has taken it to the extent I have that I'm aware of. Writing comes first. Speech does not come first. Let's say communication with sound is shared across all sorts of life. I mean, you can hear cicadas, you can hear katydids, you can hear grasshoppers. You can also hear the squeaking of subterranean mammals. You can hear a tiger's roar. You can hear monkeys or apes getting territorial in the trees or on the ground with howling to indicate their territorial boundaries, or birds making all sorts of noise if a hawk comes in and it threatens them. So communication with sound is as old as life, as best we can tell, or almost as old as life. But the problem with communication with sound is that it doesn't stay. If I utter a word, how long does it hang in the air? It's gone as soon as I say it. So if you imagine a time before there were spoken words, you have to think about how we got to not having conventional meaning to having conventional meaning. And I don't want to get too esoteric with it, but let's just look at it. When I say conventional, I mean it only has meaning because we agreed on it. It's arbitrary. And right. That arbitrariness is at the core of what's been weaponized against us. So what a linguist would say is that in Latin you say arbor, in English you say tree, and in Turkish you say ağaç. All those things mean tree, but they have no relationship one to the other, which means that the term is totally fucking arbitrary. You could choose whatever you want. It doesn't matter. It's all arbitrary. Now think about that arbitrariness together with tabula rasa, with utopian programs of social engineering. The fundamental idea is that man is something separate, a blank slate. I mean, now Skinner and other people got into the idea that you could do experiments with animals and you've got operant conditioning and, you know, Pavlov's dog and this sort of thing. But the fundamental idea is that you can sort of erase what's there. You can brainwash, right, and replace. So you can go to tabula rasa or you can go to utopian social engineering. The idea is that you can make it what you want it to be because it's all fundamentally arbitrary. I hold, and much of that comes from the idea of language, because all these different words, they're all arbitrary because all different languages use different words for the most part. And yet we know that they can still talk and communicate. So it must all be arbitrary. Meaning must be arbitrary. I take a different view, which is that writing was the first thing that stayed so it could be shared and understood. If I look at a wolf track on the ground, I don't only have an indicator of wolf. I have an indicator of a specific wolf. Because normally with this sort of thing, you've got kind and instance. A mark can show you what category it falls into, and then there's an instance of it. So think about a tally mark. You make a hash mark for each thing you count. The hash mark is the covers the kind of what you're counting, and the tally mark is an instance of it. With tracks on the ground, you're actually reading a story. You can follow the wolf tracks, and you can say the wolf was here, and then it caught the scent of some deer, and now I can see how its tracks are now following behind the tracks of the deer. And after a distance, you can look at the tracks on the ground and say, wow, this deer is obviously getting frightened because now there's a greater space between the tracks, and it looks like the wolf is in pursuit. And then you can get to where the wolves caught up with it, and you can see blood on the ground and the rest. That's a narrative. It exists in a line, just like our lines of text. We read them as we follow them. And as we follow them, we re-experience what was laid down by those marks. Now, you can say as all of the leftists do, as all of the forces of progress do, that the spoken word came first and then there was text, and that writing is always an accident of language. It's always something that comes after language. Writing is something that could not exist if there was not speech first, because writing must be to capture speech, mustn't it? And they hold this to be a self-evident truth, and it's the root of everything. And by saying that speech came first, they say that arbitrariness came first. I would like to argue, and am arguing, and will continue to argue, so that the so-called right wing, so that nationalists, however they construe themselves, can be armed against all of this, that our first form of communication has nothing to do with arbitrariness. And taking quite a bit of excellent thinking from a Briton, he's now passed away, named Roy Harris, I take up his integrational semiology, which is the idea that you don't assess the value of anything that you're communicating with based on whether or not some speech circuit has communicated the meaning of the word from the speaker to the listener. The idea is instead that all of this signification that goes on around us is the purpose of it is that it integrates and regulates our behavior so that individually we can integrate our own behavior over time. We can remember the past, imagine the future, and confront circumstances in the present, but we can also cooperate as a collective and do things together. So they talk about how words are communication. Well, what about when you're on a battlefield? There are all kinds of, I want to give you an example of integrating behavior, right? Because we have the idea of communication, a semiotics of communication, which goes with language and has arbitrariness at its heart. And then there's what I am offering, which is the idea that our fundamental models of meaning should be about integrating our individual behavior across the course of our lives and time, and our collective behavior, both in time and in space. Right? As an individual, if I'm an animal marking my territory, I have area for food caches where I buried them. I have areas for mating sites where I spawn and rear young. I have borders that I patrol, right? And the closer I am to the center of my territory, the more ferocious and effective I will be in defending it. This is mathematically shown with statistics. Animals, as they get driven into their own territory, they're much more ferocious and much more capable of defending. We also say, everybody knows that, you know, the advantage goes to the defenders, right? As soon as animals get beyond their territory, they start to get nervous. They start to look weird around, like take a cat to a new house that it hasn't been to before, and it's sniffing around to find the other marks in space that others have left to figure out if this area is contested and if it has to be worried. But after it's left enough marks, it feels comfortable. It can orient itself in time and space. Hold up the idea of writing on the page, which is the earth, which is all that exists around us, of landmarks and orientation to integrate behavior. Hold that up on one side, which I see as a form of writing, against this gaseous invertebrate concept of words and their ambiguity, and that they came first, and at the core of all human understanding and organization is arbitrariness. So hopefully I'm not getting too esoteric. I want to
let me get something clarified. Do you believe that the written word preceded the spoken word?
Animals were leaving tracks on the ground that could be read.
Yes,
long before anyone ever conceived a conventional word.
Yes, but conventional words, though.
Conventional means we agree upon them. What is all of our language?
Yeah, well, spoken, verbal language. Was that first written or was it first spoken? Like, as the language that you and I are using right now, this kind of thing.
My hypothesis is that there first had to be some object that stayed over generations so that meaning could adhere to it. So think about this thing where I look at something, I come across this, and I happen to go, pen. How does that stay so that everyone can agree on it, so that it can lock itself in the memory, so that it can become associated with that thing? The object itself, tokens, so the acorn representing the oak, the droppings of the animal we're hunting, which later, say, the Elizabethan period among the English, were gathered together in horns called fumets, so that you could describe the animal that you were pursuing by showing its shit and tell what size it was, how healthy it was, the tracks on the ground that you read that showed tokens and environmental marks were the first things that we used to integrate our behavior, much as all these other species do. The fundamental thing that's going on with the utopians, with the forces of progress, is that they think human beings stand apart from nature. They're so anthropocentric that they believe that an enormous disjunction occurred with the emergence of man.
Well, you see this all over the
place. We speak and we share nothing with animals.
Yeah, you see this all over the place, that they think that we are uniquely different and separate, that our animal instincts can be suppressed and ignored. This is universal. I mean, like, they're male and female. They'll say, you know, there is no such thing as a man. But that's obviously flying in the face of any observation of the animal kingdom, like the mammalian kingdom, where, yes, there are males in each species and there are females in each species. I mean, it's, yeah, this is why I don't even know how they could be bothered to espouse the idea that, you know, maleness is purely a social, or masculinity is purely a social construct. I just don't. It's just incredible to me that they could say that.
It's because they've planted arbitrariness at the roots of all our social conventions through the belief that man is different from animals and that speech came first and speech is arbitrary. Speech is the great thing that made possible the emergence of civilization. And then later they talk about writing. You know, writing is really what did it, but speech had to come first. No, we organized ourselves similar to the way that animals do. We only have a short amount of time left. And I want to give you plenty of time to give question and answer. So can I steal,
Well, let me just clarify this. So words, the written word, I would think that the written word came after the spoken word.
It depends on how you define writing. If you define it as the academics do, which is writing proper, which means only those things that are known to capture and preserve spoken language qualify as writing. You see, they've defined everything else out of the picture. They call it proto-writing. They call it graphemes. They come up with every kind of word they can to push it out of the pale and not address it as what it actually is, which is writing. And by defining it that way, they can keep the notion, the erroneous notion, that speech came first.
So what else would you describe, would you categorize as words?
What else would I categorize as a word?
Yeah, what do you think preceded speech, spoken language?
A broader definition of writing, which means, which I define as the marked environment. So let me give you an example.
Okay. That's a good way to do it. Right, now it makes sense. Now what you're saying, I can understand.
The first page is the space that surrounds you. The first writing surface is your environment. And it is not arbitrary. If I am an animal patrolling my perimeter and I come up on a tree and there's a scent mark because another dog
in your environment
has pissed on it, then I, as an animal, can come up to it and sort of sniff up the tree trunk. Anyone who's walked a dog has seen them do it. They find a place where another dog is pissed. As they patrol their route in a sequence, very much the same way each time they do it, because it has to do with their borders and their territory. Interesting things that are very much associated with nationalism, but not with progressives. We'll come back to this later. As the animal patrols its borders and its territories, it comes up on a tree trunk. And it says, here's an interesting scent signature. Is it recent? Or is it something that happened long ago? I can tell by the strength of the scent. That is like what we call croning in programming, or a date stamp, or a year tag on our license plate, right? And the animal can sniff up and he can say, wow, this other animal's urine is way up here. It's like a foot higher than anything I'm pissing hits this tree, which means with no arbitrariness, whatever it was that passed in that place recently was there X amount of time ago. It's not arbitrary because the scent fades and the animal can tell how recent it is. And it's not arbitrary because it indicates the height. The larger animal actually pisses higher. Now, there are animals who will fake it. Pandas have been videotaped doing handstands, pissing against the tree trunk in order to seem much larger than they are. But this is a form of writing. And it happens in sequence. Again, we're reading it like letters, like following the marks on the ground. Anyone who thinks that some vocabulary appeared before people started paying attention to tracks on the ground is, forgive me, a fool. If you don't know how to hunt an animal, you're not going to eat. And let's take it another step. If you don't know how to recognize the environmental signs around you that indicate the presence of, for example, a Siberian tiger or some apex predator in your region, you're going to become a meal. So before our ever turned into fucking anything, we had to read the marked environment. And you know what's so strange? You know, topography, topology aside, generally you're looking at a plane. If we want to reduce it to the simplest thing, rather like the plane of page. And you're looking at following the marks in a sequence. If you look at Boustrophedon way back in the day with ancient Greek, they used to first write the Greek one way across the page, and then they drop down and go the other direction, making a mirror version. They call it Boustrophedon, which means ox turning, because it's like an ox plowing back and forth across the field. Some languages, they'll go from top to bottom, and then from top to bottom again. They'll go left to right, right to left. But they're covering the ground and they're reading the character order in sequence like tracks. Tracks always have a direction, unless you're Hermes, who has stolen Apollo's cattle, who tricks by putting on a false set of footprints and walking in reverse. That's deception. That's another thing. Deception can occur with non-arbitrary communication, but it depends upon the idea that your marked environment has survival value. That's one of the things that I wanted to get at the beginning. Remember when I talked about how they insert that pause between you being confronted with something and you formulating a spoken or physical response?
Yes.
And how they get you all, I don't know what the fuck to do. They make war on instinct and they stop it from functioning because men are something separate. Men, anthropocentrism dictates that we are different from all the animals. We have speech and writing, which they do not. We are the tabula rasa, and our great wise overlords can in future determine how best to arrange what we are to satisfy what is just and equitable. No, we have instinctive responses, and they come from reading our environment. I mean, look at the way in which we generally try to hide scent. We want to mask it with perfumes. We want to wash it away. You don't want to be close enough to smell someone unless you happen to be very close to them. That's a whole dimension that we have pushed to one side in favor of the visual, and yet it still continues to work on us beneath the surface because it's not arbitrary. You can smell sickness just like a cancer-sniffing dog can. Try to find the most beautiful person you can imagine, and if they smell like shit, you're not going to have a crush. Likewise, find someone who looks a little odd, but you love how they smell. It's instinctive and non-arbitrary.
So to summarize this then, how the hell do you summarize this? The contention from the left, let's just use that term for now, the contention from the left is that the world is arbitrary because the way we talk about it is arbitrary. The way we discuss it and represent it is arbitrary. And that is because speech is arbitrary. And the labels that we give to things are arbitrary. But you're saying that predating speech, there is a much less arbitrary form of communication which emerges directly from the environment and leaves signs of narrative stories.
That all have survival value if heeded.
Yes.
Unlike the left.
Yes. Yes. And right. Okay. That is crucial. And that these narratives are undeniable because of the signs of themselves that they've left behind. So in other words, it is a valuable survival mechanism to be able to read the environment, to be able to read stored static messages in the environment.
And that additionally, that's all very well said, but additionally, I would add that when you are reading such things naturally, when a cat smells or a dog smells some weird shit in its patrolled environment, like it's inside the house and it's moving around and it's checking its little scent signatures in the corner before it turns three times to lie down, right? Checking, make sure everything's all right. Let me sniff your ass. What's going on? What's going on? Are we good? We're good? Okay. Right. But say it comes across this other scent because another dog's been there and it can't see it anymore. The dog's going to be a little bit freaked out. It's going to be like, oh, what the fuck? Where did this other thing come from? Right? It doesn't rationalize about it. It smells it and it has a response. It sees it and it has a response. Which brings us back around to this point that you had raised earlier, which is that they insert this choke moment in us so that what would flow naturally is not permitted to do. This goes back to something that Frode said that is, for those who don't, I know you know, but Freud and Midyard stands for guided culture. Right. Great guy. He has an excellent point that he's made many times, which is that leftists are forced to expend ever more time and energy writing vast tomes and volumes in order to explain to you why it is that their shitty predictions that are never accurate should in fact be paid attention to.
Yes, because they're constantly running up against reality.
And they have to try to find some way to blather and blubber and explain to you why it is, again, you shouldn't trust your own fucking lying eyes. Why you should not allow the instinctive impression that you have received to move you without any recourse to rational imagination and prediction and the rest. You know, there are certain things where you can trust your instincts immediately. And in fact, you have to. If you've ever spent any time dealing with things outside of word-based reasoning, if a group of flamencos change their rhythm on you or are coming to a close of an improvisational moment, if you tried to think about what was coming, you'd be left off from the side and they'd be done and halfway home by the time you had sorted it all out. But if you turn off your rational mind, it gets the same thing with jazz musicians. You hear somebody, they're doing a riff, they're coming up to it, and somehow these experienced musicians all just end on the same instant because they can feel it. They don't have to get all, you know, tangled up in their underwear with, you know, well, what could this mean? And well, And so by inserting that gap of arbitrariness and self-doubt between the impression and the action, they corrupt and destroy our ability, both individually and collectively, to respond to the circumstances of our environment. So
then we need to rely on them to rescue us from that inevitable confusion that comes from there.
And they always have to step in with ever more complex rules for what it is we can or can't say. I mean, I looked at this thing with differently abled because that used to be the joke for handicapped people. You'd say differently abled, or, you know, it used to be crippled and then it was handicapped and then it was differently abled. Apparently what you're supposed to do now is talk about, I guess, people. I can't even follow it. It's something.
Is it something challenged?
No, it's worse. Now what you have to do is talk to them, talk about the person who actually has whatever the congenital condition is. As perfectly normal, and I guess it's not disabled because they wouldn't accept that, but there's something basically where you talk about the person who has the condition normally and then everyone else you talk about as being not this other thing, so as not to make them feel left out. And if you go to like the Brown University page on how to refer to this, I looked at it a couple weeks ago, it's literally a page and a half that you're supposed to memorize for how you're supposed to deal with this circumstance. Now think about that. You roll up on a person of color, you know, and you're just going to have a conversation with them. Next thing you know, you're a bumbling imbecile because every natural response of yours has been shut down. It's like the old joke about, you know, where they show the bell curve and they show like an idiot Wojak with a smashed in tricycle head on one side. And on the other side, they have, you know, the super chat smart guy. And in the middle, they have the midwits. And, you know, the super chat smart, it's like for women, you know, the busted head Wojak guy is going, they'll burn down your double wide, right? And over on the other hand, you've got the super high IQ Chad who's saying, don't ever let them get the upper hand, you know? And then in the middle, you've got believe all women. And
yeah,
and now I'm not saying this is not all, they're wonderful women, but you take my point. There's this, and that curve shows you the largest number of people in the middle. And they're the ones who have had this falsehood, this meme virus, if you will, whatever it is.
They're the ones who are clever enough to understand the conditioning, but not clever enough to reject the conditioning and undo it.
Yes. I mean, there's a great one that Academic Agent put out in the last couple of days where he talked about this thing, never attribute. He's a bastard. He tries to throw it all on us in Gen X because he's sort of a millennial. He's trying to, you know, crap upon his elders, dirtbag. Judas, but he came along and he has underscored, and I think quite rightly and quite perceptively, this statement about never attribute to malice, which you can disguise as which you can explain as stupidity, and if you really dig at this, and this is what he did quite rightly, I think, and wisely, it's basically like you're stepping forward and saying, be rewarded for your stupidity while we continue our corrupt activities. Because if you say never attribute to malice what can be explained by stupidity, then then that's like the word conspiracy theory. I mean, are you saying that there's a conspiracy? And it's like my friend said, Tim, the rich, only the poor conspire. The rich simply make plans. You know, there are all of these little fish traps. They're like fish weirs. You know, as the water flows down a stream, you make this sort of angled line of stakes, and the fish are driven to the central place where you catch them in the woven vines, and you get to pull them out. It's a fish weir. The current pushes them into it. And so these explanations that we have, this midwittery that becomes a little eddy that they all get trapped in, amounts to these silly little Skinner boxes, these little linguistic Skinner boxes.
Well, and worse than that, the midwit thinks they're really, gets excited about these things. You know, they think they're clever for invoking this trap, springing this on you. And you can only just, you know, despair for them. Because, you know, I just find it incredibly tedious. But I know that the person coming up with it thinks that, you know, they're really clever. Like when they say, well, you know, there's that hilarious meme about this. Foreign people who don't belong in your country commit crimes. I bet that people who do belong in your country commit crimes as well. It's brilliant because, it's like, yeah, I've been in that conversation many times back in the day, and they always think it's so. They think they're great, and sorry.
Not at all, because it's a good point. Abstract away all of the conventional meaning communicated by everything you just described. Like, assume that whatever the rah, 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 rah sounds are that happened in that little vignette, because there are 100 different ones that you could pull out as an example. But in the end, all you see is a face looking at you and going, harp, 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 harp. Leaving all of that aside, the importance of the spoken language, instead, look at what you see. It is someone who has been, for all intents and purposes, in terms of their agency in the world, utterly emasculated. And they sit there before you, chasing their own tail in this scrabble babble fucking Kabbalistic game of manipulation. And again, their instinctive reaction has been shut down.
Well, yeah, but of course, what you've got to remember is that the social mechanisms at play reward them for doing that. They reward them for chasing their own tail. You know, it's not just something that they're doing for the sake of it. It's they are rewarded socially for this behavior, whereas of course we are punished for not doing it.
Yes, on the surface, but if once again you step outside the framework of these words and their meaning and just look baldly at the survival value, look baldly at their prospects in terms of becoming an endangered species in their own territory, look baldly at the quality of their life. Step outside language and look at the fundamental aspects of what animals use writing for. They use it to patrol their borders, to establish rank and hierarchy, to control territory, and to identify lineage and bloodline. Those have all been cast into the outer darkness. Or like, you know, Gandalf, you know, fighting with the Balrog, you know, I smote him and he fell upon the face of the mountain. You know, all those good old things associated with survival value have been cast into the outer darkness. So you can say that they're rewarded. You can say that they're rewarded, and they can feel rewarded as they chase their own tails in their minds. And yes, there are real consequences. You certainly have paid them. Nevertheless, look at it across any scale of time. They're gone. They're disappearing.
Yes,
they're,
of course.
They're becoming nothing.
Yeah, in the short term, they're rewarded. In the short term, they get the affirmation of doing this. In the long term, they're wiping themselves out. It's kind of like that. Well, I don't need to. Yeah. It's a pretty gross metaphor that I could have gone into there, but to do with the bulls being castrated. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. It wouldn't really add anything. So you know what I mean. It's something that they think is good for them at the time, but it actually isn't.
Yeah, and they end up against the wall with it. And now, in terms of some attempt at a closing statement, how much time would you say we have left? I know you also need a break between your videos?
Oh, about 5 minutes.
All right. Well, basically, look at this idea of what we talked about with the arbitrariness of spoken language, and that is affirmed as axiomatic by all the linguisticians, right? And their idea, which is frankly preposterous, that all languages have equal value because all communities use them to organize their behavior and communicate the information they find necessary.
Right. Okay. And we love all communities, of course.
Yes, because it's all one level playing field. They have created a false... How shall I say this? There are things called internal, and this is something Roy Harris came up with, internal and external syntagmatics. Internal syntagmatics belong on the page. So there's an up and a down on the page. Syntagmatics, syntagm, it's linking together meaningful elements in a sequence, right? So on a page, you have internal syntagmatics with writing, which is recording speech, also other kinds of writing. But the internal syntagmatics is that you write this sentence and it goes from top to bottom and left to right. Out there in the big world, you have external syntagmatics, which is where you need to know what direction to orient. Is east where the sun comes up? Is west where it goes down? Do all maps organize around north? You know, you can play games with organizing the page in a different way, and it might make it difficult to read if you fuck with internal syntagmatics. But with external syntagmatics, imagine a group of drunk teenagers coming to an intersection and rotating the street sign so that it points the roads in all directions, and suddenly you're disoriented and you can't do anything. They have convinced us that what we must focus on is internal syntagmatics, the games that they play with the written and spoken word, that we must be focused upon the page where we can get locked in these recursive loops. You know when you're reading a book and it's a little bit beyond you, just at the limits of what you can capably read because you don't have a lot of background on it and you're trying to pay attention to it, but then you find as you're getting a little bit more tired in bed that your eye is just recursively looping the same paragraph. Like you're coming back to the sentence because you're like, I just didn't quite get this. Let me just start again. I'm not really getting the groove on this.
That actually happened to me just last night.
That is what they do to us with the doubt they insert into the ambiguity, which they affirm is existing always between a signifier and a signified. You get lost. But out there in 4D space, not 2D space of the page and their worship of the written word, which goes back to worship of the book, which goes back to religions of the book, which goes back to sacred texts, which we didn't have in the West until the arrival of Christianity, because we had a hexameter commemorating some Pythian pronouncement at Delphi, right? We had inscriptions saying X made me, right? But we didn't have the religion of the book and the idea of the text and of a scribe who was tasked with reading and interpreting the thing for all the rest of us. There were priests who had to read and interpret the signs, the events around us in the world. But then we brought in this import, which was the idea that it was all in a book and only certain people were allowed to read it and interpret it. And part of that, I think, has contributed to where we are today. How do I wrap this up? Good God, I'm going all over the place. 2D space over on one side with words and language. 4D space, which is the actual world. They can say arbitrary all day long, until it steps on my survival value. I think that what we should do is focus upon space and time and how we orient in space and time, which is the form of writing that predates writing proper, having its associations with spoken language. We should focus on what actually gets used to help individual members of a species, as well as the species itself, survive. We need a semiotics, a theory of meaning that crosses back over to our animal inheritance and does not reject it and recognizes it as being present among us even today. There's so many different ways that I could dig into it and show you examples. We just don't have the time for it, but I'll take... I'll take one, I guess. Signatures. You would imagine that a signature should be legible. And if what they tell you about writing is true, then it's to communicate meaning. And the letters must be understood as representing phonemes. And the phonemes should be able to be strung together to yield our understanding of a word. conventional and arbitrary, of course, but a word. Otherwise, how could this thing work? And yet it's not true. It's not true. Signatures are designed to be illegible. There are some people who write quite legibly, but for the most part, the signature is something that should be executed only by that one person, so that it's effectively a trace, so that it cannot be imitated by anyone else. The same thing happens when someone is patrolling a line of graffiti in a neighborhood where one gang is coming up on the border of another gang, and so each day they walk tagging, and they try to do everything that they can to make sure that their tag cannot be read, even though it's composed of letters. Because then that trace which they leave at the border of their environment as a signal that it's their territory cannot be imitated by anyone else. So it serves its function as a mark in space, but it does so by being illegible. So all these people focused upon the idea of writing proper only following speech and being concerned with its legibility or illegibility, they're fools. We have to come back around. We have to bridge the gap from our rejection of our animal past and look to our environment, to our hierarchy, to our borders, and our territory. And those are nationalist concerns. And those are precisely the things that we see, certainly all mammal species, many insects as well, focusing upon in terms of how they mark their own environment.
All right. One last thing. By being illegible, would you say that makes the graffiti tag, or indeed someone's signature, by being illegible, is it not also immediate? Because it cannot then be reinterpreted or altered, or it is something. It speaks off the thing that created it, and literally nothing else.
Yes, that's what Peirce called a trace. So Peirce has icon, index, and symbol. The trace is what I talked about with a track left on the ground, and that's what I meant when I said that if you read a particular track of a lame wolf that's male and is fully mature and is alpha, by looking at it, you're not just seeing. That's why I was talking about kind and instance. You're not just seeing a mark that means generally wolf. Like if I write wolf. You're seeing a mark that indicates wolf as a category and wolf as an instance, but it also indicates a very specific wolf and no other. And that's what our signatures are. We make them illegible for the same reason that the Japanese wear a little cylinder thing around their neck. They don't sign their name. They bring a cylinder that they're a seal that they are supposed to maintain control of at all times and report if they lose it, and they make their stamp. The idea is that it cannot be anyone else. And it's anything but arbitrary. Again, ownership, property. Look at our basic grammatical understanding of subject and predicate. Subject is to make something subject. Predicate is to say something about it. In Latin, predicare, to speak publicly, to pronounce. Subject and predicate, so we can talk about, I gave him the book, right? You can break that down grammatically, but look at what's at the root of it. By making a mark upon something, you make a predicate upon it, and thereby it is made subject. Just like someone who wears the insignia of the house that they serve. Just like someone who's been branded with an M for malefactor or a V for vagabond. You make it subject by placing a mark upon it. And that's why our earliest writing in the West is very simple formulas that say things like X made me, because it shows where it came from and claims it. It's a sign of ownership and of control. And if you are a man of character from a known, noble, gignosco, we won't go into that etymological train, but if you come from a house that is known, then you have a sign that is remembered. If you are a nobody, then you're head count. You're just counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, head count, cattle, chattel, capital. Only those who have a character, who are known, who remember themselves across time, this is another nationalist aspect of my whole theoretical framework, only those people stay. Only those people are remembered. Only those people carry anything forward for their lineage. So there's many ways that this, I'm once again winding all over the place, but.
I am interested in this idea that by being illegible, the thing is speaking of what created it and of nothing else, and conveys multiple aspects of the thing that created it. I think that's a very, that in itself seems like a very interesting point.
If it's a trace. Look at the earliest look at the earliest forms of writing that we know of. Now, they don't call it writing. They call it proto-writing if you look into the various people who wrote about it, written about it. But look at tracks on the ground, and then remember again the caves at Chauvet. Then remember again the caves at Dordogne. Remember the caves, the upper European Paleolithic sites where they have all the markings on the walls. And they paint these interesting animals. And then if you look at them closely, you'll see they have weird marks made on their bodies. It's almost suggest cattle brands. Or taking a branch covered in paint and pressing it against the side of the beast so you can track kind and instance category as you gain your sustenance from everything that passes. But look again, and that's animal husbandry and the rest and domestication of species, but further down the road. But look at, most importantly, what's on the wall. Handprints. Handprints. Over and over and over again. What are handprints but human tracks? What is a handprint but a signature? Look at a thumbprint. Or look at the idea, since you seem to like this business of the arbitrariness, look at the idea when you go to the bank and you sign a check, but it's for a big amount, so they want to make sure that everything's done right, right? What do? Do they read it and they say, oh, well, this says, let's just call you Millennial Wos, right? This says M-I-L-L. Do they read it as that? And then they go, oh, it says Millennial Wos. That must be you because you're Millennial Wos. No.
Yeah. And you're the only one who knows how to spell it correctly.
What they do is they pull an authorized archetype, which is your signature on file. And they compare your previous handprint, your previous track, your previous trace or signature to the current one. And there's nothing arbitrary about it. Imagine if you introduced arbitrariness into that domain. They're perfectly happy to allow you to introduce arbitrariness with fiat currency or in immigration numbers or crime statistics or COVID deaths or views, likes, and subscribers or election results or the meaning of words or company valuation or demographic data or pollution or unemployment numbers. They are never going to allow you to introduce the slightest bit of arbitrariness into the mark that you make to give or receive money. There, it's all about whether or not it matches the authorized archetype, and it must be a viable trace. Once again, underscoring what I'm talking about, they let us play off in the pasture with arbitrariness and this and that, and they pat you on the head, and they say, go on, enjoy yourself, play out there. But where it matters, outdoor advertising, you have to have special stuff for the state, from the state in order to place, you know, billboards and all the rest. It has to meet a higher standard. If you break somebody's copyright and reproduce something, you might get a civil lawsuit. Try reproducing in an unauthorized way any kind of currency. In the U.S., you're going to have treasury agents with submachine guns show up because they care about that. That's not arbitrary. That has to match the authorized archetype. It must have absolute meaning. They will not come after you for stealing someone else's words or reproducing them. They will come after you for stealing, for faking someone's signature or for screwing around with fiat currency. They'll be there in a New York minute, faster than, what did Razor Fist say, a hummingbird on Coke's heartbeat. You know, there's not going to be any delay. And so we're stuck off in this area where we get to play and we get to complain, for example, about what's going on with what the progressives are doing to our language and how they keep changing meaning around. And we don't even know what place means in a legal statute, and our terms of art are all jacked up and we have to be worried about this and that. Where it matters, where it has survival value, where it entails control, there's no arbitrariness at all. And that's, I think, what we need to understand. And ultimately, that's what I'm pursuing with my Semiotics and Nationalism. I have a number of publications on these ideas that I've put out thus far. If anybody's interested, you can get in touch with me at semiagogue@protonmail.com. There's one book called Traditional Marking Systems. You can find it on Amazon. I co-authored it and wrote the first chapter in it and did part of the co-authored, co-edited. I was one of the editors, one of the authors that helped write the introduction. There's also one on, it's in a Festschrift for Roy Harris in Elsevier Language Sciences. It's on the origins of writing. If anybody wants to reach me, again, you can get me at semiagogue@protonmail.com. I'd love to talk about it more, and I will be in future, because if we continue to allow these Scrabble babble rearrangers of letters to manipulate us in the land of the arbitrary, and we do not set forth a point of orientation then there is nothing that we can integrate and regulate and cooperate in our behavior with and around as a central point of orientation. Because fundamentally what they're doing is they're removing landmarks. Note that landmarks exist in the environment that actually surrounds us, and that landmarks are used to organize communities locally and to allow us to figure out where we're going when we're traveling, how much of the night sky has passed by, to how much time has passed, where the sun is in the sky, gnomon, sundial, clock tower, minaret. They all manage the times of the day and our location in space. If we don't embrace those things again, then we lose our connection to that which is real, which is not arbitrary, and we lose our focus upon things that have survival value.
Excellent. And I guess the distinction that's immersed here at the end is that those with, well, let's say, the powers that be, maintain, defy their own preaching and maintain a very non-arbitrary hold on things, whilst encouraging people into this, as you say, playground of arbitrary drivel. That alone is a very interesting point, and very very pertinent point. Okay, well, let's leave it at that. I think this has been a fascinating discussion. I'm sure it will bear rewatching certainly for me and for many other people. So, thank you very much. I have linked to your YouTube channel below, and hold on a second. Yeah, I think that. Yes. And I hope that this drives some more people to your channel. People are asking for us to just keep going on for the whole 2 hours, but I can't possibly do that. If you want more of Semyo Gog, then you should subscribe to his channel. So please do so, because he puts out content very regularly, and it's always reliably highbrow and nourishing and often very amusing.
Yeah, it's often quite strange as well. Yeah, I figured you are now on what this is your third interview, and you have yet a fourth one to go, and it's very much later where you are than where I am. So thank you very much for having me on. Thank you very much for indulging my going into this topic. I apologize for the ways in which it is not entirely coherent. There's that old statement, you know, they say I would have written you a shorter note, but I didn't have time. Yeah. I'm still in the midst of laying this out, but when I do have it properly distilled, I think it will be rather something, and it's time for us on the right to advance on the ideological front as well as on the academic and intellectual front, and I'm hoping that this will be my own little contribution towards it. But in any case, thank you very much, Woz, very much indeed. It's great to be on here for the third time, and it's been a great pleasure.
Well, I hope it isn't the last time. Just before we go, I'll read out... there are two super chats now. Great stream. Looking forward to a return of clarity, truth, and hierarchy. Merry Christmas. Thank you very much. And then someone else says, there is something about the winter solstice in particular that makes me crave a simpler, more communal way of life, closer to nature. It is, I imagine, just one of the many irreconcilable torments of modern living. Well, yes, I think we all feel that way, Johnster. And, well, that's part of what millennial is designed and intended to alleviate, that awful sense of that everything's so much as bullshit in the modern world. So, you know, we can analyze it and we can also try to alleviate it. So, okay, well, thank you very much, Semyo Gog. And in the meantime, I'll be back in about 40 minutes with Robin Riley, Critical Condition, CC Buckle. Haven't decided which of those three names I'm going to address her by yet. I'll maybe work that out over the next 40 minutes. I'll be back then with her. In the meantime, Semyo Gog, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2020. All right. I'll see you all later. Bye for now.